It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some economists say a lot of jobs lost during the pandemic will never come back, and that's creating a big demand for retraining. An economics reporter joins us with the details. First, the start of the trial for a former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd last year has been put on hold. Jury selection was supposed to begin today, but the judge sent potential jurors home while an appeals court reconsiders whether to reinstate a third-degree murder charge against Derek Chauvin. Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. Floyd, a black man, was arrested outside a Minneapolis convenience store on Memorial Day last year. Bystander videos showed Chauvin, who's white, kneeling on Floyd's neck while Floyd was handcuffed and repeatedly saying he couldn't breathe. Floyd later died in custody. The incident sparked mass protests and violence in the Twin Cities and beyond last summer, and Minneapolis has seen new rallies leading up to the trial. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges. Three other former officers have also been charged. Their trials are scheduled for the summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see in the outcome of Chauvin's trial? Does the case have meaning to you personally? What questions do you have about the case, the trial process, use of force standards, or other details? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again. Thanks to the audience.
Before we get into the details of how this trial will work and what the judge and jury are considering, David, can you just talk about the mood in the Twin Cities after a tumultuous year right now?
Well, if we were to take a visual sort of tour of, let's say, Hennepin County in Minneapolis in particular, it looks like the city is prepared for a war. And what I mean by that, the county courthouse, or the county office building where the trial is occurring, the only thing going on there right now is the trial. All the other offices, all the other trials have been relocated or moved. There is double concrete barrier walls put on the outside, as well as barbed wire, razor wire fences. It's in pretty much a lockdown mode. Most of downtown Minneapolis, the businesses are boarded up or closed. And even in St. Paul, where I am, I'm approximately, let's say, maybe 5 miles from there. A lot of businesses and so forth, the police departments, government buildings, have either told people, don't come to work, work remote on top of the pandemic, and have additional security. So it is incredibly tense right now where we also have some National Guard also patrolling at the same time. So it's a very, pins and needles, I think, is everybody would be the description we could use.
And there have been, I understand, some rallies, I believe, peaceful, David, especially at the site where George Floyd died at what's now called, I think, George Floyd Square.
You're absolutely correct. There's been peaceful protests all through the weekend. And I don't think anybody is worried about the peaceful protests in the same way that nobody was worried about the peaceful First Amendment protected protests that happened, you know, last May. What everybody's worried about, of course, is what we saw that happened in Minneapolis and unfortunately in many other communities across the country, where we had rioting, arson, destruction, and so forth. And that's what I think everybody's concerned about here, is that during the trial and perhaps once we have a verdict, what will the community reaction be as a result? And clearly all that hangs over the trial, because I think one of the big themes we have to be thinking about here is, given how well known the events were, I'm certainly all of your listeners, or most of them, have seen that 9-minute video. We know it's circulated across the world. There's a real serious concern regarding whether it's even possible to have a fair trial, given all the exposure and how difficult it's going to be to actually get an impartial jury. It's going to be very difficult.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and University of Minnesota, looking at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, a charge for murder and manslaughter in the George Floyd case, of course, a well-known case. David, talk to us about the specific charges that are filed, and then we'll talk about this third charge that's actually delayed things for a moment.
Sure. Now, right now, there's two charges against Derek Chauvin. First of them is called second degree manslaughter. And what you have to show to prove somebody is guilty of second degree manslaughter, not only did they cause the death of a person, in this case, George Floyd, but they did it with, and this is the language of the law, with culpable negligence. And this is going to be difficult to figure out what actually means to be culpable negligence. Was the mere placing of the knee on George Floyd's neck indication of culpable negligence, or do you have to show something else? But if you can show that there was culpable negligence and Derek Chauvin caused his death, second degree manslaughter is punishable for up to 12 years in prison. The other charge is second degree murder. And in this case here, it's what's called the felony murder rule. That what the felony murder rule allows is that if you're in the act of committing another felony, in this case, an assault, and somebody dies as a result, you can charge the person with felony murder. And if he were convicted under that, then it would be up to 40 years in prison. Now, the other charge, which is pending, and we just don't know what's going to happen as of right now, is that the prosecution wants to get third-degree murder reinstated. Third-degree murder was one of the original charges brought against Derek Chauvin. The judge dismissed it. And then after the Minnesota Court of Appeals about a month ago upheld the conviction of Muhammad Noor, another police officer who was convicted, what, about 2 years ago in the shooting of Justine Diamond, he was convicted of third-degree murder. And the Court of Appeals upheld his conviction. And so now the prosecution wants third-degree murder reinstated. They had a Court of Appeals decision last week that said that this district court judge should consider reinstating it. And then this morning's dispute was all about whether or not the judge had any authority to act to reinstate, hear any motions, or whether the trial could actually proceed at this point. So that's where we are in kind of limbo. It almost sounded kind of funny this morning when the judge said, well, we have an appeal now going to the Supreme Court on that Court of Appeals decision from last week. We don't know what the Court of Appeals meant in its opinion last week. And this is the part that sounded a little funny. He said, I called the Court of Appeals and left them a voicemail to see if they'd get back to me. So it kind of sounded a little funny in terms of that. But it's where we are at this point. We're just in a holding pattern and not knowing how long it's going to take.
Now, the importance of this third degree charge, there's in some cases, maybe especially involving a police officer's, juries might be reluctant to have the most serious charge. Having that third degree charge, I've seen some analysts say, gives a middle ground between the most serious charges and no conviction at all. Is that a fair way to read that possibility?
That is a very fair way to read it, is that it would give perhaps, let us say, a jury that is not sure what to do, not sure if they're convinced on those two more serious charges, might be willing to strike a deal amongst all the jurors and say, yeah, we can at least agree on a third degree murder charge. And given the fact that at least for now, one officer has already been convicted of it, Muhammad Noor, a pending appeal to Minnesota Supreme Court, that at least gives some precedent to say to a jury, yes, you can in fact convict on third degree murder. This would make the prosecution a little bit easier because as we all know, it's very difficult to successfully prosecute and get a conviction for a police officer, both because the law authorizes police officers to use force and because of the qualified immunity that police officers enjoy. So third degree might be making it easier to get a conviction.
We're talking about the upcoming trial for Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis last year. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You can join in with your thoughts and questions about the trial at 800-642-1234. Are you going to be following this? What do you want to see happen as an outcome of this trial? Do you have questions about how all of this works? The charges, police policy, jury selection, other aspects of the trial? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the upcoming trial for Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd last May. Jury selection was supposed to begin today. The judge put it on hold while an appeals court considers whether to reinstate a third-degree murder charge against Chauvin. David Schultz is with us, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Can the guest tell me why Keith Ellison, the attorney general for the state of Minnesota, why did he take this case away from the Hennepin County prosecutor? Thank you.
Good question, David.
Okay, good question. A couple of reasons here. First is that many of the community activists and many people within the African-American community in Hennepin County really did not trust Mike Freeman, who's the Hennepin County attorney, to be able to handle the matter. And so there was pressure to bring the attorney general in, Keith Ellison, to do this. Additionally, eventually, the court ruled that the Hennepin County attorney had a conflict of interest in here because some of his staff had done some investigations into this case that sort of conflicted them out from being able to handle it. But the listener raises a very good question here, is that in the state of Minnesota, the attorney general does not normally do criminal prosecution. In fact, it defends the state of Minnesota in civil matters. It defends the state or sues for, like, let's say, consumer fraud issues. It does not have a criminal prosecution unit. And it certainly doesn't have experience in terms of prosecuting police officers. They brought somebody in to help. But this is important to note here because the defense, Eric Nelson, for example, is exceedingly skilled in defending police officers. And the four officers, but particularly Derek Chauvin, have among the best police officer defense teams in the country. So this is going to be interesting to see how an attorney general whose office is relatively inexperienced in a very complex case like this is going to fare.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. And let's talk about what you mentioned earlier, the standard, the high bar for successfully prosecuting police officers for the use of force. What, according to past court rulings, what are some of the presumptions, some of the lenses that courts look at these cases through?
Well, first, of course, let's just talk about the sociology that officers are generally very credible. There's also a lot of, let's say, goodwill that jurors give to police officers. So we just have to keep that in the back of our mind, too. But first, every state in the country, including Minnesota, authorizes police officers to use force in a variety of circumstances, on top of which the U.S. Supreme Court has given police officers what's called qualified immunity. And essentially what that qualified immunity means is that when a police officer uses force, we have to judge that use of force from the perspective of what a reasonable officer would be thinking at the time that the force was used, and that we can't, this is the court's language, we can't second guess that person. And among the reasons that a Supreme Court has said that officers are authorized to use force is when they believe that either their life or the life of somebody in the public is threatened, or, among other things, if the person who they are trying to apprehend is resisting arrest. Now, not all those conditions may apply here, but put these together in terms of state law as well as qualified immunity from the Supreme Court, and the law significantly favors police officers when it comes for the use of force. So it's a very, very tough thing to do in terms of prosecuting police officers. I think I just found out recently, as looking at some statistics here, that when prosecution is brought against police officers, about 40% of the time are they able to get a guilty verdict. So this is a relatively low percentage compared to, let us say, many other trials.
And stacked up against that, people will look at that video, I think, and refer to what appears to be a helpless person being knelt on, his neck being knelt on for close to 9 minutes, passersby raising concerns about his well-being. I mean, is there, just with the nature of this video, is there something here that you think is going to raise over that bar, David?
Well, the video certainly is going to be something that the prosecution keeps wanting to throw out, and they're going to show numerous times to the jury and refer back to it. But they also are going to have an autopsy, of which they're going to have at least one expert that's going to claim that it was the knee on the neck that caused asphyxiation that eventually, you know, led to George Floyd's death, which means Derek Chauvin did cause the death of him. On the other hand, the defense is going to bring out their expert witnesses, and they're going to say that an autopsy revealed that George Floyd had COVID-19. I think one estimate said that he had about, 80 to 85% of his lungs were already full of fluid. I think, if I remember correctly, autopsy also pointed out that he had fentanyl in his system. So the defense is going to raise the argument to say that it might not have been the knee on the neck that caused the death of George Floyd. It might have been something else. Remember, defense doesn't have to prove that. All it has to do is what? Raise reasonable doubt. And if they can raise enough reasonable doubt, that could be enough to sort of trip the case. And so the video is damaging. But certainly we also know it's not going to be the only video. Apparently there are police cams and a few other videos and witnesses that the jury is going to have to review.
In our last half a minute, David, the jury selection process delayed right now. Can you just give us a sense of what happens in that process?
Well, what's going to happen at this point? We're in a holding pattern until the Court of Appeals gets back and says, can you proceed in terms of jury selection? Can you, more importantly, consider at this point the third degree murder charge or not? I think most of us are anticipating that the Court of Appeals will get back to the district court within, I'm going to say, a day or so, because otherwise we're going to be pushing this trial out quite a bit. And you can't really impanel a jury if you don't know when the trial is going to be.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. We talked to them about the upcoming trial for former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd last year. For some Wisconsinites, the pandemic has led to unexpected financial gains. They work from home and collect the same paycheck, but they're not spending money on things like restaurants like they used to. But for others, it's meant severe financial hardship. WPR's Rachel Vasquez reports on the workers who are bearing the brunt of the economic downturn.
On a cold January day in Green Bay, Rita Love is looking for a new job.
Like this one here is in Florida, and it's a delivery driver for Amazon. Flexible, $18 to $25 an hour.
She's not finding anything in Green Bay, so she says she might relocate. Among the endless listings, she spots a housing intake job that she has experience with.
Wow, and I didn't even see this one. Let me look at this. I hadn't got to this one yet. This is one that's new that's been sent out.
Love says she lost her job at a keg repair plant in March and has been out of work for almost a full year. Unemployment helped for a little bit, but she went without the extra money for 2 full months until state officials launched new extended benefits last week. Love said she'd already been cutting back for months.
Well, what I did was not charging anything, even if I needed it. It had to be a real necessity. And far as my cable was concerned, hey, I can cut that off too, but I need my internet.
She's seen the balances in her bank account drop, and now Love is borrowing money from family to get by.
My brother sends me a couple $100. My daughter, who works overtime, just so she can help me out.
So how many people in Wisconsin are struggling like Love during the pandemic? The Marquette Law School poll has been asking people about this since 2016.
Would you describe your family as living comfortably, just getting by, or struggling to make ends meet?
That's John Johnson with Marquette. He says when the pandemic started, the data they were getting back on that question confused them.
At a top line level, the numbers have been remarkably stable over this year. And in fact, in our most recent poll that we just released, we had the highest number of people saying they're living comfortably since we started asking the question in March of 2016.
That was a full 67% of respondents who said they were living comfortably in late October, despite an economic downturn that's brought historic levels of job loss and business closures. So why does it look like people are doing better than they were before the pandemic? Experts say it's because of the way the recession has mainly impacted certain kinds of workers.
So people in the state have been having this extremely divergent experience based on if you're someone who is in a precarious position, a vulnerable job, or someone who is able to keep working from home. And maybe the largest financial hit you took was simply stopping spending so much money at restaurants or going on vacation.
Marquette's own data confirms that if you look a little closer. Over the pandemic, the number of Black Wisconsinites who said they were struggling rose by 11%, and the number of Hispanic Wisconsinites who said they were just getting by jumped by 12%. Number of white Wisconsinites who said they were living comfortably didn't change at all, at 65%. UW-Madison economist Laura Dresser says that's because Black and brown workers are concentrated in low-wage jobs in Wisconsin. And unlike past recessions, the pandemic downturn has hit those workers hard and left higher earners relatively unaffected.
Those of us who are carefully ensconced in our homes are not able to see the desperation in the communities of people who have lost work and cannot figure out how to get food on the table. And so this pandemic exacerbates that divide while giving us fewer ways of seeing across it.
Rita Love is still looking for a new job and trying to stay optimistic. She knows the family that she's leaning on doesn't have a lot of extra money to help out, and she really wants to get back to work.
As long as I'm making a living, an honest living. And that's what makes a person feel good about themselves.
So she clicks through jobs and works on applications 2 hours or more every single day, all in the hopes of getting the kind of steady, full-time job she used to have before the pandemic. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, more on this topic. Job numbers bounced up last week nationwide, but our guest says there are many jobs, maybe millions, lost in the pandemic that may not come back. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent checks in with leaders of Wisconsin's technical college system to find out how they're responding to the challenges of COVID-19 and a changing job market. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, over 10 million Americans are officially unemployed in the economic downturn related to COVID-19, and as many as 18 million are collecting unemployment. Some economists say many of the lost jobs won't be back even after the pandemic subsides. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you lose your job temporarily or permanently because of the pandemic? Were you able to collect unemployment? Have you found another job? Are you thinking of changing careers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Heather Long is an economics correspondent for the Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Before we get to whether these kinds of jobs are going to come back, I want to talk about how many unemployed Americans there are and why it's hard to know how many unemployed Americans there are. There's a pretty big range in those estimates I just gave.
Yes, exactly. And it's confusing a lot of people, including policymakers. The official number at the moment that just came out on Friday from the Labor Department says that we have just shy of 10 million people, 9.5 million people officially unemployed. But here's where it gets a little tricky. In order to be officially unemployed, you have to be actively searching for a job. So you have to have gone out, you know, on the website, on one of those like Indeed.com or LinkedIn websites, and filed your resume or your application within the past month. Well, a lot of people who are at home taking care of their kids, or maybe they have a severe health issue and they don't want to, they really feel they can't work right now because of the pandemic, they're not searching for jobs. They're waiting till they get that vaccine so they can safely re-enter the workforce, or until their kids can go back to school. And so what we know is you really need to add another close to 6 million people who have just dropped out of the labor force, especially women are a big part of that 6 million. And so that's why you hear people like the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen or the Federal Reserve Chief Jerome Powell talking about the true unemployment rate being closer to 10% and the true number of people unemployed probably a lot closer to 16 million. Because of those people who just can't even look for a job right now.
Now, we are recovering in general in the economy. And if I'm reading your reporting right, Heather, there's a thought like, okay, we may end up getting the same number of jobs back ultimately, but they're probably not going to be the same jobs. Like some sectors of jobs are going to be declining a lot. Do I have that about right?
You've got it spot on. The line I always use is we are recovering, but to a different economy. We're not just recovering to February of 2019. Things have fundamentally changed during this pandemic, particularly around more people working from home. There's probably going to be less business travel. And the big one that a lot of people forget is there has been more use and really an explosion of automation and use of robots. And that's probably not going to go away, even after all these vaccinations happen.
And let's start with that last point there, automation. What kind of lines of work have we seen automation, which presumably isn't cheap, get put into place during the pandemic, and maybe it's going to stick around after?
We've seen it a lot of places. Some of the common ones people have seen as you go out your daily life, of course, more of those ordering touch screens. When you go to do like a McDonald's or a restaurant, they're trying to cut down on that face-to-face interaction during the pandemic. Same thing at hotels. Instead of showing up and talking to that person when you check in, a lot of it is now done on your phone or done on an iPad, even at airports. If you've been in an airport, I know most of us haven't, but a friend of mine just traveled and she was saying, you know, I barely even talk to a person in the airport, even through security. Everything is automated now. And then there's some surprising ones. For years, we thought you're never going to be able to automate things like picking strawberries or things like doing in the meat packing industry, you know, where somebody is literally on that meat packing line hacking chicken off of the carcass that's moving by. That seemed to be a really hard skill to automate. And yet, in the middle of this pandemic, we have seen greater use of robots now doing more of those jobs, even in meat packing plants.
And one that I think is going to be scary for people, Heather, I think I've heard a lot of stories from individual people, and it seems like this is a trend. Okay, the restaurant's closed or the travel hospitality thing is closed, but there's a warehouse job because Amazon is going gangbusters or other shipping companies. There's lots of warehouse work. We're seeing automation there too.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that surprised me because you're right. Warehouse jobs have grown. It's one of the few industries that's grown in the past year as everybody's been ordering, or many people have been ordering goods online. But we have also seen automation picking up there. In the story, I talk about Chewy, which is where you can order pet supplies and dog food and cat food. And for instance, this company, Chewy, it's been growing a lot. A lot of people got pets during the pandemic to be that extra support animal or be that extra element of fun and joy. And at the same time, so they've been ordering all this pet food online, Chewy just opened in October its first fully automated automated warehouse. So there are no longer humans going and picking up that 50-pound bag of dog food that's going to ship to you. It's now picked up by a robot, put on a conveyor belt, and even in some cases boxed by a robot. And so you're starting to see that technology happen even in big warehouses.
Talking to Heather Long, economics correspondent for the Washington Post, looking at maybe big changes in what work looks like in the United States pre-pandemic to after pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your line of work? How was it affected, if at all, by the pandemic? Did you lose your job temporarily or long term? Are you looking forward to being able to go back to it? Have you gone back to it? Are you looking at a new career? If you worked not at home, are you working at home and maybe going to stay there in full or in part? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, if these jobs maybe aren't going to come back full force, Heather, but we think jobs are, in general, are going to come back, what are those other jobs now?
Well, exactly. Everybody's trying to figure that out. One of the boom areas, and I interviewed a bartender and a server in Miami, he worked in a hotel restaurant, and he's already made the transition. You know, he and his buddies at work were realizing that some of these restaurant jobs may not come back or may not pay as well as they used to because there aren't as many people coming through the hotels and the restaurants. And so he switched into real estate. He got his real estate license. We've seen during this pandemic a boom in home sales and also construction. Construction has also generally throughout the pandemic been adding jobs as people remodel, as people try to add on, you know, new wings to their homes, everybody trying to get these bigger properties or just nicer finishing, remodel their bathrooms. And so those types of industries have certainly done very well. Well, obviously also anything tech related. So there's a big push to get people who can do the jobs in the cloud and then cloud storage management and these types of jobs that are not necessarily, you don't necessarily need a bachelor's degree in computer science to do them, but you do need some basic skills, maybe a year or so of community college training to be able to do those jobs well.
And there's a key word you just mentioned, training. And a lot of people, looks like, are, at least according to your reporting, Heather, are thinking about this. How do we get these maybe former restaurant workers or hotel workers or whatever trained for these different jobs if this transition is really happening? How do we do that?
Yeah, I always say people are not stupid and they can see these trends happening. I talked to a Disney worker at Disney World and she can see that, yes, there's Disney will come back. People will eventually go back to these theme parks, but it may not be as many people or it may be a different type of experience. And so she, like many people, there's obviously the online courses. I've certainly heard of many places across the country that have seen swelling enrollment. One of the big surprises, though, in this downturn has been that community college enrollment broadly has fallen. That's very different than what we saw in that terrible great financial crisis coming out of that 2007 to 2009. Community college enrollment in America spiked as people were trying to retrain, to get new skills, to get that associate's degree in the hopes of getting a better job coming out of that recession. Right now, we are not seeing that. A lot of it is the digital divide. So many of these classes are online, and some of the people who need these maybe would like to do retraining like that Disney worker. She was telling me we're behind on our utility bills. We're behind on our internet bill. It may be shut off. So she can't think of taking that college class if she doesn't have reliable internet right now.
We're talking to Heather Long from the Washington Post, looking at the future of jobs in the post-pandemic era with concerns that some kinds of jobs may not make a comeback. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you need to learn new skills for the job market? Do you work in an industry that's been hurt by the pandemic, a restaurant, hospitality, services, otherwise? Will you be able to return to your old job if you've lost it? Are you looking to change completely? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Washington Post economics correspondent Heather Long. She's explaining what the economy could look like after the pandemic and why some kinds of jobs may not make a comeback, even as the economy as a whole recovers. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, and your experiences in the working world. Have you been unaffected, badly affected? Are you changing your line of work? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi, I just had a comment about maybe technology on a more global scale, right? It's inherently causing deflation in the sense that workers are more productive with technology. And I think what that's doing to the economy is it makes good paying jobs more scarce. And I'd be curious about if that perspective is a valid one.
John, thanks for that call. And I've seen that pre-pandemic too, Heather, the argument that, okay, we don't need as many, factory workers making a decent wage. We need fewer people who manage the computers and machines at a much higher wage. Is that a general trend you've seen that John's bringing up?
Yeah, I think John is spot on in his assessment. And that's sort of the theory behind automation. Yes, there's a big upfront cost, but ultimately you're going to need fewer workers down the road. And even if those handful of workers that are still left, even if they cost more money, it's still cheaper and better for the long run. I will say there's a fundamental debate about two things right now. It's interesting he brings up deflation. You know, the two big debates in economics right now are, number one, this big $1.9 trillion stimulus bill that's just going through Congress that's probably going to be signed by President Biden this week. Is that going to overheat the economy and cause too much inflation? So I'd say inflation is more of the concern at the moment. And I think the other big debate at the moment is what you and I were talking about at the top of the hour show, which is, are we still going to have jobs for everyone? Are we still going to have the same number of jobs after this crisis? Or is all of this automation, there's long been a concern that all of this technological development automation ultimately would mean we need fewer workers and that some people would basically be left behind or left out. Right now, the argument predominantly is still that we will have the same number of jobs. It's just people are going to have to do different things.
Thanks, John, for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather, we were talking about a training for a new job a little while ago. Is that a part of a federal policy, state policy? Are policymakers trying to figure out ways to help people make that transition? And I guess to anticipate what kinds of jobs are going to be needed by the time that training is done?
I'm sorry to say that in that I was surprised to learn myself in that $1.9 trillion stimulus package that's on the verge of becoming law, there is no money specifically allotted for retraining. Now, some money, quite a bit of money, is supposed to go to states and cities. And what we saw, for instance, Wisconsin's neighbor Michigan last year used some of the CARES Act money, that big bill that passed last March. They actually did a great program for retraining frontliners, degrees for frontliners, and they had over 100,000 people, a lot of people who work in grocery stores or who work as those EMTs in the ambulances, signed up because they want to earn an associate's degree at a community college or perhaps get a new certification like a commercial driver's license. And I think that just shows you that even people who have jobs in this pandemic are seeing the changes in the economy and wanting to try to better their prospects going forward.
Let's go back to our callers now. Aaron is with us in Green Bay. Aaron, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am mainly calling about jobs in the school systems. So I'm a public school teacher, and we have had many, many positions go advertised every year that aren't filled just because people aren't applying for them. And I'm really afraid that now I am not leaving the school of education, or I'm not leaving the field of education this year, but we have a lot of teachers, especially the older ones, who are being pushed out. Early retirement, too much technology, that kind of thing. And it's becoming nearly impossible to replace them. I'm really afraid that there's just not enough people getting the education required to be a public school teacher.
Erin, thanks for that call. At pre-pandemic, Heather, I know here in Wisconsin, in any way, we had concerns, especially rural schools, of finding teachers, especially in certain specialties like STEM fields, special ed, and more. You know, this is something that's a tall order to train that person. You know, you need pretty much 4 years plus to become a teacher. So that might be a tall order for some of the jobs we're talking about, to go from restaurant to third grade teacher.
Yeah, it's an excellent point that Erin made. It's interesting. You don't have to take it from me, but the head of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, Niels Kashkari, he made this point last week when I interviewed him, that in situations like what Erin is describing, when employers claim they can't find enough workers, guess what? The real solution is paying people more. It's raising the wages. Now, that's obviously controversial, as some of those teacher salaries are coming from local tax base, and so nobody ever likes to raise taxes either. But when you cannot find qualified workers, the traditional response is you need to raise wages. So there's also a debate coming out of this pandemic. Are we going to see some wage increases in certain professions? I would also just like to add, Erin makes a great point that there's been a lot of in her area, there are positions that aren't being filled. But what we also know, and we just saw this on Friday in the latest Labor Department statistics, is one of the areas that's still losing jobs, hemorrhaging jobs in this crisis, is actually not restaurants. Restaurants are starting to add back, but education jobs are still getting cut across the country. So there's both unfilled positions as well as cuts going on across the country.
Thanks for that call, Erin. We got an email from Marilyn, who says she lost her clinical position at Marquette University in January. Marilyn says, I had planned to work 3 to 4 more years, and this loss has negatively impacted my retirement plans. I'm 62 and have great concern regarding finding a position given my proximity to retirement. And that's, you know, economists talk about, the long run. Well, Marilyn's not thinking long run. She's got another few years in her career. This could really shake things up like the Great Recession did for people in that, you know, I was going to retire in 3 to 10 year category.
This is the population I worry about the most. I wrote a lot about it coming out of the Great Recession. What I found, having spent a lot of time at areas like Lordstown, Ohio, where a car factory would close, is yes, retraining works. And it's not, you know, sometimes people can find other jobs, but it generally works for people under 45. And when you get over 45, it's very hard to switch careers. It's just for the reason Marilyn is describing. Everybody knows this person probably only needs to work a couple more years. A lot of companies will not take chances on people once they get even above 50, let alone above 60. This is a really, really big problem in the U.S. economy. We definitely have, I believe, from my reporting and from reading economic research, I do believe age discrimination is real in the hiring process. And I wish I had better news for any programs that are going on at the federal level. I do not see that right now.
Marilyn, thanks for writing in. Best to you. Heather, in our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for next on these stories?
Well, I think there's definitely going to be a surge probably this summer in hiring. We're already starting to see a little bit of it with some of these restaurant jobs beginning to come back. But the big question is how many people will still be out of jobs by the end of the year. And I have a bad feeling that could still be several million people who need jobs and more importantly, need careers that pay well.
We'll leave it there. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your time.
That was Heather Long, economics correspondent at The Washington Post. She joined us for a look at the future of jobs when the pandemic is over. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of Americans felt burned out on the job before the pandemic, and now burnout is a way of life for many people. A guest tells us what's behind that problem and how to help fix it. The CDC issued new guidelines on safe health behaviors after we get a COVID vaccine. Check out those recommendations, and you can join in with your questions. Raising teenagers can be difficult in any time, and there are new twists now in our interconnected world. The author of the new book, Raising Global Teens, shares practical advice for modern-day parenting. Plus, we'll look back at the unique career and influence of filmmaker Stanley Kubrick from Dr. Strangelove to 2001 and beyond. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. This is a great time of year for bracket competitions, and here's one for us in Wisconsin. The Sheboygan Press wants you to vote for your favorite Wisconsin water tower. You can do that on the Sheboygan Press website. They've got a bracket set up, and we're going to talk about water towers on Wednesday. But right now, Central Time producer Bill Martins has a surprising amount to say on the topic. Hey, Bill.
Hi there.
You grew up a water tower fan, I just found out today.
I did, yeah. It goes back to, I would say I was probably like 5 or 6. I remember, and I'm not sure why, but I remember, like, we would go visit my aunt. I grew up in Green Bay. We'd go visit her in Chilton, and I would just look at all the water towers that we would go by. And I don't know if it was just because Green Bay didn't really have any tall buildings and that the water towers were the tallest things, and I thought they were really cool and colorful and different shapes and designs and different fonts and stuff on there. But I don't know. There was something about them that I just thought was really cool, and I still kind of like them today.
And you started drawing them? Do I have that right?
I did. I started one day when I was little, I started drawing all the water towers that you go past, and I made a little book out of it. Don't remember what it was called, but sold plenty of copies of that.
Now, I don't want to sway the competition at the Sheboygan Press, but do you have a favorite water tower of Wisconsin?
Gosh, if I had kids, that would be like asking me my favorite
all right,
child.
That's fair.
Yeah, I can't give you a better answer than that. Oh, no, I should say there was one in Milwaukee. All right, I'll tell you later.
Okay, we'll leave it in suspense.
I know we're out of time.
We are out of time. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time.